Welcome back to Minds Matter, a podcast sponsored by the Monash Center for Consciousness and Contemplative Studies. I'm Ava.
And I'm Beth. And on Minds Matter, we talk about research from psychology to neuroscience whilst talking about our own personal experiences.
This week on the podcast, I spoke to Dr. Rachel Lowe, who is a lecturer at Victoria University of Wellington. And on this episode, we spoke about emotion regulation strategies like suppression and reappraisal and how they can influence our intimate relationships, and also how these can even spill over from parents to children in family contexts.
Hi, I'm Rachel Lowe. I am a lecturer in social and developmental psychology at Victoria University of Wellington, and that's in New Zealand. So generally, my area of interest is emotion regulation in social relationships. So my PhD research focused on how couples regulate or control emotions when they're having conflict with their partner, and what kind of spillover effects this might have on their family functioning. So after conflict, when they have to interact with their child, what happens then? I'm also interested in emotion regulation strategies in children. So how children learn to regulate difficult emotions in social situations as well.
Could you tell us a little bit or give us a primer about what emotion regulation is and what some common strategies are that people use to regulate their emotions?
Yeah, so there's a couple of different definitions, but the easiest way to put it is how people control their emotional experiences and also how they express emotions. And I think when people think of emotion regulation or emotion control, most people think about what we call down-regulating or reducing negative emotions. But it can also be instances where people are trying to increase positive experiences or increase positive emotions.
So it's just generally how you try to change the way that you're feeling, be it upregulating or kind of downregulating?
Yeah, so you can think of it as modifying your emotions, whether it's increasing or decreasing positive or negative emotions.
So you've done research looking at particular kinds of emotion regulation and how those influence people's goal pursuit for individuals through the pathway of negative emotions as well as interpersonal outcomes. So how those emotion regulation strategies influence their interpersonal relationships. So could you talk a little bit about those findings, where I think you specifically looked at emotional suppression and how that influenced the context of goal pursuit?
Yeah. So one of the most common strategies that people use and can probably easily relate to is the use of emotional suppression. So think about a time when you're feeling really sad or really angry. And this is most, I guess, obvious when you're in a social situation where you feel like you don't want to appear sad or angry. And one of the things that people commonly do to hide that is by suppressing their emotional expression. So trying to hide or inhibit how you're feeling. So that refers to both inhibiting or suppressing what you're expressing to someone else, but it's also trying to bottle up negative emotions on the inside. So one of the things that I wanted to do in this paper was look at, well, one, do people try to suppress their emotions when they face challenges in the context of pursuing goals? Because when you're pursuing an important goal, like trying to get a PhD, your paper might get rejected or your supervisor tears apart your work. And that can elicit really intense or sad feelings. So there were two studies in this paper. So the first one, we tracked students across a semester. And at the beginning of the semester, we asked them, all right, we want you to identify the most important personal goals to you. So at the start of the semester, so most students wrote getting good grades, yeah, getting healthier or fitter or improving relationships. And then for the rest of the semester, every 2 weeks, we sent them a questionnaire and we asked, all right, so, you know, it's normal to face challenges when you're pursuing your goals. To what degree or to what extent did you try to suppress your emotions when challenges came up? Or to what extent did you try to think about it in a different way? So think about it in a way to make you more positive about the situation. And then we asked them every 2 weeks, about how they felt about their goal. So how competent they felt, how much effort they put into their goal. And we also tracked how successful they felt with regard to achieving that goal. And what we found was that the more people use suppression when they face challenges or when they are faced with negative emotions with regard to the specific goal that they chose, the worse these outcomes were. So the more people suppressed their negative emotions, they reported putting in less effort, they felt less competent, and over time, they also reported feeling less successful with that specific goal that they identified.
So just for kind of application of this work, for people who maybe feel like they're like hearing alarm bells as they listen to your findings there and feel like they do suppress some of their negative emotions when they're in goal pursuit, what is the alternative strategy that people can use?
Yeah, that's a good question. And it makes me think of the broader emotion regulation literature. So we know a lot about what not to do. So we know, for example, when you're pursuing goals, suppressing is bad for goal outcomes, but we really don't know what to do. Like, we don't really have much insight at the moment as to the most adaptive strategies. And that's because a lot of the research often look at strategies like independently. So they don't really compare them to something else. And the most common ones they compare, if they do, is emotional suppression and reappraisal, because that's the ones that just kind of like blew up when James Gross identified it in his process model. And that was the one that was pitted against each other. But if you look at the research, it's not as clear as to what people should do. But I think if we draw from research on mindfulness, and there is some evidence not directly relating to pursuing goals, but just in general, like the more adaptive strategies, I think it's really important that we pay attention to the feelings and emotions that come up when we are faced with challenges. And that includes when you're pursuing personal goals. So, you know, when you get a rejection letter or something elicits sadness or anger, even though suppressing might feel instinctive because you just want it to end, like you don't want to feel sad, you don't want to feel anger. But I think research shows that it is important to kind of delve deeper and try to reflect on those feelings or seek support. But that's all I can really say about what's an adaptive alternative.
So to be clear, in your findings, were you looking only at emotional suppression, or were you also looking at reappraisal? So when people are like, oh, maybe this isn't as bad as I thought, or reframing, does that also count as trying to avoid those negative emotions, or is it a fully different strategy?
It's a different strategy. So cognitive reappraisal, again, the research is a little bit messy on cognitive reappraisal. I just wrote a chapter and it was probably one of the hardest things I've ever written because the literature on cognitive reappraisal is really mixed. But generally speaking, reappraisal is defined as when an individual tries to reframe or interpret the situation in a different way. But when you look at experimental studies telling people how to reappraise, there's a lot of differences. So in some studies, it says, try to think about the situation in the positive way. In other studies, it's try to think about a situation that helps you feel calm. So because of so many differences in the literature, we don't really have a clear idea of what the effects of reappraisal actually are. But in this study, I also looked at the effect of reappraisal on goal pursuit. And the effects weren't as strong. So there was some evidence that it could be beneficial, but when you're comparing it against suppression, those positive effects don't hold. So in the same analyses, we included people's tendencies both to suppress and to reappraise. And the factor that was predicting those outcomes was suppression. And reappraisal didn't do anything when you had those two strategies together. But when you were looking at reappraisal alone, so if you're not looking at whether someone's also suppressing or not, there were some evidence that reappraisal was helpful, but then those effects don't hold. Like it's weak. So it goes away as soon as you bring suppression into the picture.
That's really interesting. So I don't know if you feel like you have a great answer to this, and it's okay if not, but again, from someone who is not really in the emotion regulation space, I feel like some of the messaging that is in line, I think, with this idea of like emotional suppression is bad, but reappraisal can be positive. I think some of the pushback to that messaging has been this evidence that in non-Western cultures, emotional suppression doesn't actually seem to come with these negative outcomes. So do you think that this, what you found in Goal Pursuit, might also be the case potentially in non-Western samples? Or did you look at any non-Western samples? And do you think that any of these findings could vary by these more contextual factors like culture?
Yeah, I think you're definitely right. I mean, we haven't conducted research looking at Goal Pursuit in a different culture. So this study was very much, it was conducted in New Zealand. So it was very Western. So I can only speculate, like based on the other research that's been done looking at whether suppression has, you know, the same kind of damaging effects in different cultures. Like usually is contrasted against East Asian cultures like Japan or China. And what they generally find is the negative effects that are usually associated with suppression is not there or is weaker. So research from the Western cultures find that emotional suppression might be effective at helping people hide emotional expressions. So you do seem less sad and less angry, but on the inside, you're still feeling those intense negative emotions, which then can lead to poorer relationship functioning, and also increases your stress, your physiological responses, like when you're really stressed out. But when you look at it in more collectivist cultures, those effects don't really, they're not really there. And some of the reasons that has been shown for this difference across cultures is because, this is really generalizing, but people who live in collectivist cultures don't see suppression as a bad thing. You know, it's not that you're trying to hold back who you are or you're not authentic, but you're suppressing with the goal of keeping social harmony, because in collectivist cultures, one key priority is to protect social harmony and like protect relationships. And so it's not as important to have to reveal or say how you feel when you're feeling sad or angry. So I think that's one of the reasons why suppression is not as damaging in East Asian cultures.
So speaking of this idea of the importance of like different goals and how relationships are so contextual, you've also looked at emotional suppression in the context of relationship satisfaction. And you've described in your findings this idea of emotional suppression as a weak link. So could you talk about that study and some of those findings there?
So this study, just to give a shout out, was led by my colleague, Eri Sasaki, who did her PhD in University of Auckland in New Zealand, but now she's doing her postdoc University in Toronto. So this is really her area of research. But in this body of work, we wanted to look at dyadic, so two people relationships. We wanted to look at, does it take two people to basically ruin something? So if you have one partner who is always suppressing their emotions, but the other one is expressing and always very open with their emotions, what does that do in a relationship context like conflict? So basically, is it enough for like one bad apple to ruin the basket of two apples? And the weakling hypothesis, and also was what we found, is that it only takes one person to damage relationship satisfaction. And in the context of relationship conflict, it also only takes one person to have the tendency to suppress their negative emotions, to inhibit or to interfere with how well people can resolve conflict.
So if someone is in this situation, like there's a relationship where there's a person who just tends to suppress their emotions, is there anything that they can do besides just like trying to work on that?
So again, there's not much research on it. So this is just me, you know, speculating. But I think one important thing to do is to reflect on why you're suppressing your emotions or why you feel the need to. So we know from the research that suppression really interrupts relationship functioning, because when you suppress your emotions, especially when you're experiencing conflict with your partner, you're not expressing your real thoughts or feelings about what's going on. So that interrupts how much your partner can understand what's going on from your perspective. But it also signals that maybe you don't trust your partner. So I think if you're a person who tends to suppress your emotions when negative feelings come up, I think it's important to ask yourself, why do you find it threatening? Like, what is it about expressing negative emotions in this context that is making you want to hold back, as a first step to delving deeper? Because it's a defense strategy, right? You're suppressing emotions. Well, one reason is because you're trying to protect the self. A really big theory in relationship science, the risk regulation model. So in a situation like conflict, you're very vulnerable, because you can either express your emotions, and if you do that, your partner might be reassuring, they might comfort you, but there's also a very real risk that your partner might shut you down. And so suppression is a way to protect the self. So I think a good first step is to reflect on why people turn to these strategies when they feel threatened.
So the threatening in theory could come from either like potentially a pattern of behavior that you feel like you've seen before in your life, like maybe something relating to something like attachment style. But then it also could just be, maybe this isn't a super safe relationship and it's about you.
Okay. Yeah. And it's so great that you brought up attachment, because attachment is one of the key predictors of what strategies people use. Both people high in attachment avoidance and anxiety both use suppression. And that's because they've learned that when you need comfort or when you need to turn to people for support, they might not always be there. And so what you've learned is, well, there's no point expressing sadness or anger because no one's going to comfort me. So the best thing I can do is to suppress them. And at least that way, you know, well, for people high in anxious attachment, that way I can still remain proximity by not scaring my partner away. So as well as suppression, people high on attachment anxiety also use a lot of rumination. So if you think about what manifests during relationship conflict, someone who is higher in anxiety would try to suppress because they're scared that they're going to be abandoned or there's going to be signs of rejection from their partner. But they're also trying to pull reassurance of love or care. And then, so they also use a lot of rumination or guilt induction, which is when like you go over the problem over and over again. And so when you're watching an interaction with someone who's enacting or using rumination, they're kind of circling the problem. It's like, oh, you always do this, that, you know, when you did this, like, it was so hurtful. And so there's a lot of exaggerated hurt. So it's just kind of conflict, I guess, where they're scared they're going to be rejected. So they try to suppress, but then they're also ruminating or exaggerating their negative emotions a lot to pull reassurance. So there's a really push-pull thing going on there. Whereas if you look at an interaction where someone's high in attachment avoidance, they suppress, but there's no leakage. You know, there's no, I'm suppressing and there's like leakage of negative emotions that I still want reassurance. Like people who are avoidantly attached, when they suppress emotions, it's because, you know, I don't like this level of intimacy. And I don't like to depend on you. I also don't like other people depending on me. So I'm going to suppress my emotions to stop that.
Well, since we've kind of been talking about conflict, you also, as you mentioned in your intro, do work not only with couples, but also with children, looking at spillover effects of emotion regulation and kind of conflict resolution strategies and how a couple fighting, how that influences how they later interact with their children. So could you talk about that paper a little bit and those different strategies that you examined and which emerged as predictive?
So in that paper, we got families to come into the lab. So these were all couples who had a child between 4 and 5. And so what we did was we separated parents and the kids. So parents were in one room and the kids were in another room doing their own experimental tasks. And for the couples, we asked them to identify their top three relationship issues. And we picked one, so the most significant one, for them to discuss while being video recorded. After the discussion, we asked them to report on three different emotion regulation strategies. And we picked these because they're the most studied, but also the most commonly used. So emotional suppression, which we've already talked about, and cognitive reappraisal. And then the last one is rumination. So rumination has mostly been studied in the clinical space. And we know that this involves repetitive and intrusive thoughts about causes or consequences of a problem. So self-talk like, you know, why am I feeling like this? You know, I'm so useless. Or why is this always an issue? So it's constant and it's repetitive and it doesn't seem to be going anywhere. So like what I said before about circling around, and it doesn't seem to be moving forward. So we asked both couple members to report on what they did during the conflict. But we also asked a team of independent observers to look at the interaction. So this was after all the data was collected, to look at the interaction and code for these different types of behaviors. So we wanted to see if when you're watching a couple interaction, can you capture how much someone is suppressing their emotions or trying to reframe the situation or ruminating about the problem? Anyways, straight after the conflict interaction, we then brought their 5-year-old child back in and we gave them a fun family task to do. So the instructions were, as a family, we would like the three of you to build a freestanding tower. The tower must stand on its own. And we gave them a bunch of paper materials like cardboard, markers, pipe cleaners for them to build something. And this was actually a really fun task to do because initially we thought it'll be a nice way to wrap up the study because, you know, we wanted to end on a nice note. And we thought it'll be quite child focused, but it was interesting because sometimes parents got a little bit competitive. And we had instances where couples or parents would kind of build separate towers and they would compete with each other to see like who's got the better tower. Anyways, so part of the study was also, we wanted to know if there were spillover effects. So we wanted to know, one, what strategies would shape how well couples can resolve conflict, and two, whether that would then spill over to the family interaction after the conflict discussion. And so after the family task, we asked both parents to rate their own responsiveness towards their child. So things like, I was warm and affectionate, I helped my child during the task. And we also asked them to report on their partner's responsiveness. So I thought my partner was warm and affectionate towards our child. So our results showed that, as expected, using more suppression and rumination during the conflict discussion predicted poorer conflict resolution. So couples reported that they were less successful at resolving conflict. But cognitive reappraisal was better for couples who were trying to resolve their problems. And then the spillover effects, we found that for suppression and rumination, because of the reduced problem resolution, this led to lower responsiveness, reported both by the self, but also perceived by their partner. Whereas cognitive reappraisal, because couples were better at resolving conflict, so they showed better responsiveness in the family activity.
So were the people who were doing more of these rumination suppression strategies, were they also the ones who were competing in building the tower, or was it just a behavior you were surprised to observe in like anyone?
We didn't actually code for that. We can. That's a good point.
That's really interesting. And I don't know if anyone who has kids listening will feel like that helps them think they should work on conflict resolution, but it's just kind of unfortunate that like it feels like if things are going bad, then it also will spill over into how you're interacting with your kids. And maybe that also is, you know, like less pleasant if you feel like you're not as engaged and present with your child that it seems like it could spiral potentially. I don't know if there's research looking at that and whether when things get bad, they continue to get bad, or whether there's easy fixes to kind of alter those situations.
Yeah, I don't think it's limited to relationship conflict and family interaction situations. I mean, let's think about work and relationships, right? So if something bad happens at work, the way you regulate or resolve problems at work is going to impact on how you behave at home, because our emotions are not just contained to one situation. Like, just because we have a stressful day at work, you know, we don't just switch off at the end of a day and then we go home and it's not like we're back to baseline. So I think this also applies when you look at other contexts as well, where people have to move from one situation to another.
That makes a lot of sense. So at the beginning, you mentioned that you've done research also on children's emotion regulation strategies.
Yeah. So this was a fun study because in the developmental space, the way we study emotion regulation is first we have to elicit negative emotions. And so what that means is in our experimental task, we need to like frustrate the kids. So in the same study that I talked about just before, so while the couples were in one room having a conflict discussion, the child was in a separate room doing a task where they had to compete with the experimenter. So you know those ring stackers with like the different colors going from big to small? So we told the kids, so you have your own ring stacker and I have mine, and we're going to race each other for 5 rounds. And the person who wins the most rounds will get a special prize. But what they don't know is that it's manipulated so that the children never win. And so as you can imagine, for some 5-year-old kids, like they were completely fine. But more often we found that some kids were frustrated, they were really upset, or they were quite anxious about the situation. So basically in this task, we tried to elicit one of these negative emotions and they always lost. But straight after that, we asked them, which was quite mean, I think, but it all passed ethics. So straight after that, we asked them to cooperate with the same experimenter. So now that you've just lost to this person, we now want you to work together. So using some Lego to build like animal structures. And so similar to what we did with the adults, we coded for how much children try to suppress or control their negative emotions. And actually with children, we found that for kids who showed more attempts at suppressing, they actually showed less what we call antagonistic behaviors during the cooperation task. So antagonistic behaviors like trying to take the experimenter's turn, or like hogging the toy for themselves, or like snatching or taking the piece away from the experimenters. So in this case, suppression actually had a beneficial effect in kids, so they were less antagonistic.
Were there links between what the parents were doing and what the kids were doing? So if the parents were more likely to suppress, were the kids also more likely to show that pattern?
Yeah, again, something that I haven't published. So what was so fun about this study is you already know that we got measures of parents' self-reported emotion regulation, what they were observed to do. And we also asked parents their perceptions of what their kids do. And then for the kids, we only have observed because, you know, they're 5-year-olds. So we can't ask them how they regulate their emotions. And when we ran those analyses, it was so interesting because parents' self-reports of their own and their reports of what their children do wasn't associated with what was observed in their kids. The only thing that did was what parents were observed to do. So it really supports like the modeling hypothesis where children do what they see. So that was a really cool finding.
So this is a place where you would not want to trust self-report. Could they reflect on themselves, or it was like specifically just that they weren't good at predicting what they thought their child would do?
So in that same paper, we looked at the correlations between parent self-report and observe, and they were correlated, but weakly. So there is a connection there. In terms of what parents' reports of what their kids do, that's a little bit harder to answer because what we asked parents to report was on like generally what your kids do, right? But what we were assessing was this just like one task or one snapshot. So it's really hard to know whether parents are inaccurate or if it was too limited and we need more instances to see what children do, if that makes sense.
So are there any takeaways from your work that people can try to apply in conflict in their own lives? Are there any like easy kind of habits that can be implemented, or is it really like slow working on yourself, getting to know yourself, asking yourself deeper questions of why you're suppressing? Or is there anything that maybe people can apply more quickly?
Yeah, I don't think there's a quick fix, because from what we know, you know, these emotion regulation strategies that we turn to are so rooted and they stem from our attachment styles, which means that think about, even though you know what might be the best thing to do or the best thing not to do, when you're in a situation where you're really angry or really sad, you know, you can't just do the right thing. So I think one of the things that people can do to help is to address conflict or to bring them up maybe when you're not as heated, because negative emotions can really get in the way of effective communication. And you might turn to those strategies that you're so used to and that can really interrupt what you need or how you're expressing to your partner.
So, Ava, when I was listening to Rachel, I was laughing to myself about suppressing emotion, because I think that both me and you, well, I don't know, I don't want to speak for you, but I was like, I never suppress emotion ever. Like, not ever.
Really?
No, I feel like you would know that about me. It's constant.
No, you're very open with your emotions, but I don't know. I wouldn't have dare assume.
Even when she was speaking about, you know, the goals that we have and suppressing emotions around those and the examples with supervisors, I tell Jakob my emotions all the time. It's amazing that he puts up with me. He knows my thoughts and feelings about my work constantly. When people say, oh, my supervisor doesn't really know how I'm going or what I'm doing, I'm like, cannot relate. And then even when I came back from Paris and I had my terrible breakup and I was really sad, I would come into the lab and just lay on the ground and cry.
What? I didn't know that.
I didn't suppress anything. No. And I was like, would talk about all of that in the workplace.
Wow. What a fun lab to be in. Just Beth sprawled on the ground or perhaps in fetal position. Well, you're modeling good behavior. And the idea was that if you're suppressing in a relationship, then that can lead to bad outcomes. So maybe that's why everything's going so smoothly for you. I guess maybe there needs to be a follow-up in the realm of a lab environment to see if that holds up. But I will say that one of the things that Rachel said about that was that if you are suppressing in a relationship, right, that doesn't necessarily just mean that like you're the type of person to suppress. It also means that like maybe you don't feel safe in the relationship. So I think we should give a shout out to Jakob, because yeah. he might just be providing you like a really safe space. And I feel that there might have been other work environments for you in the past where you were not coming into the lab fetal position, though you might have wanted to.
That is very true. It's the space I'm in now allows me to do that. But it really, really does help.
That's interesting. I don't necessarily feel that way, though. I think my biggest problem is sometimes I don't realize that there's an emotion that I, quote unquote, should be suppressing. So one thing that happened to me with my advisor recently, which was not about anything in our relationship, but he's very sweet. He's a really, really sweet person. And there was a big social psychology conference that all of our department was going to, but he wasn't going. And he announced to the entire department, like, oh, Ava and Lee, who's my lab mate, are going to be at this conference and I'm not going. So make sure that you take care of them and make sure that you invite them to dinner. And I was just caught off guard. And apparently I made a face. And then he came up to me afterwards and he was like, Ava,
I'm really sorry if I embarrassed you because you just made exactly the same face that my 8-year-old daughter makes when I embarrass her. So I think sometimes it's okay to suppress at least like the outward emotion. I didn't even mean to act like I was, you know, an embarrassed daughter or whatever. But I think sometimes I have problems suppressing my facial expressions, which I have heard from people that I'm in classes with. And I guess now from my advisor.
I think I know the face, to be honest.
It's bad. No, it's bad. I remember when we did our masters too, people would be like, oh my God, Ava, your face. Like if someone said something that I disagreed with. So
you can always tell. That's true.
But I definitely think I suppress emotions sometimes for myself.
Mm, yeah, okay.
Not necessarily for other people. Like I think.
Examples?
Well, we're getting into it. So my therapist and I were discussing this just this week. But I think one of my biggest problems, like to keep it in the realm of work-related things, is I run up against a lot of negative emotions when I'm like engaging in some work because I'll feel stressed out that like, oh, if I do this, then if I fail or if like it's hard, then I'm going to have to deal with the fact that I'm actually deep down like I'm stupid or something. I don't know. And so I feel like not wanting to deal with that negative emotion, or maybe sometimes it's just that I don't want to be bored, makes me like not engage in my work at all and then makes it much worse. So definitely I've experienced that, like trying to push away the negative emotion is directly unhelpful to my goal pursuit as an individual. But I don't know if it's worked like that in my relationship, which I think was interesting and like something that I wouldn't have thought would go together, that my individual suppression in my own goals can influence outcomes within a relationship.
And I guess there's also the level of, so we feel a lot of things. Well, I feel a lot of things. And I do know that there are times where, okay, this is something I'm feeling that maybe everyone doesn't have to suffer through with me. And I don't know if that's depression, but I guess that's just like social awareness. So there is this, okay, well, I'm feeling this way, but I know I'm feeling this way because I've got X, Y, Z, or this is going on and I need to like check that or regulate that so it's not imposed on other people.
That's an interesting point because I know that there's some evidence that in relationships, there's something that you can do called accommodation, I think, which is where if your partner annoys you or does something or they get mad at you, they snap at you and you feel the urge to snap back at them, but you suppress that response, that is also really beneficial to a relationship. So it sounds like sometimes suppression is good, but maybe it's really suppression in the context of something that's really important to you and maybe like a continued issue where it gets to that point where if you're not sharing it, it can lead to problems in the relationship, but also maybe be indicative of there already being a problem. Like you don't trust that person. Whereas if it's just like trying to accommodate kind of like how you're saying, like, I don't want to just bring in my own stuff to this for no reason, that can be helpful. So maybe there's like specific situations in which if it's important, you would want to say it, but if it's not important, then it turns into accommodation, which is good for the relationship. The study about like parents and kids I thought was really interesting. I don't know if that resonated with you and also made you worried about one day having your own child and being like, what will I pass on to them? That kid's not going to suppress anything.
We'll be such an emotional little household.
Everyone in fetal position.
Well, when I was a nanny for children, I was always like, we can be emotional and there's space for everything. And there was a lot of love and care.
Do you feel you saw that in families that you worked for, that like you would see the kids mirroring their parents, or maybe like some of the families, if the primary caretakers were actually nannies, you like wouldn't see a lot of the parent in the child?
Yeah, I think if the primary caretaker is a nanny, then the children actually do learn a lot from the nanny, which makes sense, I suppose. So I think, yeah, definitely. You got to make sure you get a good nanny.
Yeah, seriously. I don't know. That's going to be a problem for us, for the PhDs on the PhD salary.
But yeah, I'm a lot like my mom too. So that doesn't surprise me. We're very similar in how we deal with conflict. And she is more conflict adverse than I am. Mm-hmm. So I have a bit more. I'm doing a bit more standing up for myself, but my mom is just oh, hello, everyone. Everything's lovely. Like she gets in situations where like the council knocked down her front fence or her front veranda. And so the council did it, but she's paying them a lot of money. And like, she's that kind of person. And I feel like I haven't exactly.
What?
Ava's doing one of her faces.
Wait, hashtag justice for Beth's mom? Wait, what do you mean? Why is she paying them?
Because they were like, oh, it was derelict or something. It wasn't. She's got a really cool house. But then she doesn't like conflict, so she just kind of went along with it. And I used to work for accounts, and I was like, Mom, no, this is just... She's like, oh, you know, I feel like everyone at some point in their life has to pay a lot of money to the council, and now it's my time.
What? That's so interesting. That makes me think, okay, because at some point I asked Rachel, because there is evidence that suppression is supposedly really bad in Western contexts, where I guess a lot of importance is placed on like the individual expressing themselves. And that's something that we strive for. But in more collectivistic cultures, especially East Asian cultures, I think there's testing being done on this in cultures in Latin America that are a bit more like expressive, but still collectivistic. But in those East Asian cultures, at least, suppression isn't actually that bad. Like it doesn't come with at least these individual well-being issues. And that's because your goals are just different. So you don't necessarily value expressing yourself as an individual as much. Like it's more about maintaining harmony. So in that way, suppression isn't bad because it's just in line with your goals and this like broader cultural framework. But it sounds like maybe your mom has kind of adopted like a different way of thinking about the overarching goal of her life, and that she just needs to pay the council at some point, and she might as well do it now.
Everyone's gotta do it.
Yeah, so maybe we just all need to kind of adopt fully different worldviews about paying the council to be able to be okay with it. And suppression, I mean, in that sense is fine.
It has kind of worked out because she's not upset about it or stressed about it.
Yeah, so it feels like how you see suppression and how it fits into that broader kind of worldview is really important.
Yeah.
Whether you're Beth's mom or you're a Japanese person in Japan. One of the other papers that you had was this paper about feeling loved and how that can buffer against like destructive behaviors. It kind of made me think about, which I feel like has had a resurgence on TikTok, but Gottman's analysis of marriage and this idea of like the five positives to one negative and how that's really predictive of lasting relationships and happy relationships. So has that idea of the 5-to-1 ratio of positive to negative, has that held up over the years in relationships?
I think that's such a great connection that you made there. So with that original paper, I mean, first of all, I think that was just something that they found, as in when they compared the two groups, that they found that there were 5 negative events to 1 positive event. But I don't think it was meant to be applied as concretely in daily lives. I don't think people should, and they can't anyways, to keep track. All right, like there's 5 positive things, and then now I can have like 1 negative thing, it'll be fine. But what we do know, though, and this is research by Lisa Neff and some of her colleagues, is that having more positive emotional capital is important. So emotional capital is when you ask someone, like today, your partner gave you a compliment or your partner made you feel loved or valued. So having more emotional capital of positive things in your relationship has beneficial outcomes for you and your partner. So in one of Lisa Neff's paper and Courtney Walsh, they found that the more emotional capital you have, you're more likely to interpret your partner's behavior as less bad, or you're more forgiving. And that in turn made you more likely to forgive your partner's transgressions. So even though it's not exactly a 5-to-1 ratio, but it does speak to when you're not experiencing conflict, one thing that people should spend time or invest in is to create those nice moments with your partner, so that when you do have conflict, having more positive moments to draw from can help buffer some of that negativity when conflict comes up.
So the question that we always end with is just, what are you working on next that you're excited about? And I know we've touched on quite a few things, but if you want to share any new things that you're looking at.
The one that I'm most excited about at the moment is looking at, so there's starting to be more work looking at emotion regulation within relationships. But we know that our intimate partners are not the only source of support or people we turn to. So I'm really interested in looking at how people support network and how people distribute their emotional needs. So when I'm feeling sad, maybe I'll turn to my partner. But when I'm feeling angry, I'll turn to someone else. So people turn to different people depending on the purposes. So for example, there's a lot of work on this in the friendship space. So some friends you turn to because you want them to like almost amplify your negative emotions. So let's say something bad happens at work and you want to vent about this person. And you know that if you turn to this one best friend, your friend will give you the responses you want. And then so what ends up happening is this process we call co-rumination. So you go, oh, can you believe this person did this? And your friend's like, oh my goodness, I can't believe they did that. And it's you're building upon each other's negativity. Whereas you know that if you turn to your partner, for example, they might try to regulate you in a way to, you know, be less angry and be like, oh, maybe they just made a mistake. And so we know that people turn to others for support, but we don't know how this influences people's emotional well-being and what's better or more adaptive. So yeah, I'm looking forward to expanding my emotion regulation work beyond just the diet and looking at people's family and broader friendship circles.
Thank you so much for talking about your research and sharing your time with us. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, Ava. That was so much fun.
Thank you to Dr. Rachel Lowe for joining us this episode. Our intro and outro music is Nobody Stayed for the DJ by Glacio. Our transition music is Back for More, also by Glacio. Minds Matter is mixed, edited, and created by Beth Fisher, she's the Australian one, and me, Ava Madisouza. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a brand new episode, but in the meantime, find all our episodes and show notes on mindsmatterpodcast.com.